Hello everyone and welcome to this very special Hollywood edition of the Big Boat Interview. This conversation with James Cameron took place a little earlier this year. Cameron, of course, needs little, by the way, of an introduction. Between Titanic and the two Avatar films, he is responsible for three of the five highest grossing movies of all time. We actually conducted the interview in anticipation of our September issue, which is, as ever, our adventure special and is on the shelves on the 10th of August. No one knows, as I discovered, more about adventure than James Cameron, who is at heart an explorer. He was the first person to make a solo trip to Challenger Deep, the deepest point of any ocean on Earth. He's also dived the Titanic more than 30 times and likes to say he has spent more time on the ship than its captain. In the interview, Cameron discusses his recent investment in Triton submarines, what inspired him to start going deep, and why movie making is really just the day job. So without further ado, here is my interview with James Cameron. I hope you enjoy it. So what are you doing in New Zealand?
You mean besides living here?
Oh, I didn't know you lived there. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Well, don't be sorry. It's actually wonderful. So we live in Wellington and we have a farm outside Wellington, and the studios are here that Peter Jackson built, which we use for our Avatar films and so on. So it's all a nice little ecosystem right here.
You've had a lot of rain recently. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. And in LA too. And it seems like I've traveled back and forth and caught every rainstorm.
Yeah. Well, I'm from the UK, so I know all about that. Well, thank
one thing about the way, the one thing about living in New Zealand is you never complain about the weather, because that would be a pathway to unhappiness. You celebrate the weather.
Yeah, rejoice in it. But it is, I mean, what a place to live. I mean, my God, it's just the most beautiful country on the face of the earth, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be even better if I actually got outdoors once in a while instead of being inside doing, you know, animation and performance capture and all the other stuff we do.
I should say also congratulations on the continuing success of Way of the Water. I mean, it's Way of Water, rather. It's done phenomenally well.
We're in a curious situation this week where we will just creep up and begin to pass Titanic's worldwide cumulative box office at the exact moment that Titanic is re-released and moves away. So it's a moving target we're chasing.
I mean, do you ever kind of, I mean, it's not a pinch yourself as much as, do you ever just think it's, you know, I'm responsible for two of the three highest grossing movies of all time?
Technically three out of four, but who's counting?
Three out of four. So you have 75% of...
It's a bit bizarre, and it's certainly welcome because these projects are expensive to make. And if I like doing what I'm doing, I naturally want to be able to continue that. And so, you know, the Avatar saga will play out over time, over the next, you know, 6 or 7 years. And so success is sort of an entry level requirement in the weirdest way. Yeah. You know, I've always said it was the silliest business model in history, that we had to be in the top 10 or whatever, or we couldn't proceed, you know. So, but, you know, I think when you walk into the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, in Los Angeles, in the entryway, there's a huge wall that says, "Dare Mighty Things." And I've always loved that motto. If you don't dare mighty things, you can't do them. Nothing happens.
Well, I mean, that kind of leads us quite neatly onto the topic of this discussion. Obviously, you know, we operate in the large yacht space. We have a great relationship with Triton, and that's, and you've recently taken a stake in the company. So how did that come about?
Well, it was a number of converging factors. So Patrick Lahey, who runs the company, founded it, co-founded it, and has developed this fantastic line of commercial submersibles that are, you know, sort of recreational and can be used for exploration, can be used for anything a deep submersible can be used for, really, is an old mate of mine from my expedition days. So when I bought the Deep Rover submersible system that consisted of two subs that were the kind of bubble subs, the first of the bubble subs, with Mike McDowell, who's another expedition guy. We bought them together and took them over from Canal Plus. I brought in Patrick to refit them, revamp them, and be our expedition lead to run the submersibles for us on our expedition. So we went out and we did deep sea hydrothermal vents in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge down to the Azores Islands and so on. And so Patrick and I have dived together. We've done one major expedition together, and we've dived together, and I've seen him as a submersible pilot. Now he's gone on to be a submersible designer and project manager, and has built this whole line. As you know, Triton's line is quite comprehensive. And meanwhile, I was off building my own sub to go to, you know, the deepest sites in the world. And we were looking over the fence at each other and saying, oh, are you going to do that? Well, we're going to do this. And he'd say, well, we're going to do this. And so we've always stayed close around the engineering part of it. So when this opportunity came up for me to invest with Ray Dalio in Triton, it just made so much sense. Plus, two of the Triton subs are already on the Ocean Explorer, you know, Ray Dalio's, you know, mega expedition ship. And we're doing a big show in conjunction with BBC and National Geographic called Ocean Explorers and Ocean X. I call it Ocean X. And those subs are operating all the time as a result of that project, which I'm an executive producer of. So it all just seemed to kind of converge to it making a great deal of sense. And now as a minor equity participant, I'll be able to sit with Patrick and think about, you know, what features we want to add to the vehicles, maybe whole new vehicle programs that come out of our brainstorming sessions. So it's actually pretty exciting.
Yeah, it really is. And given your, you know, very broad imagination, I imagine there's quite a lot. It must be quite a fun creative process, imagining the future of what Triton could be. And I'm wondering if you've taken any steps in that direction. I mean, have you got a kind of a 5 or 10 year plan for the company?
There's certainly a 10-year plan, and we've vetted that together. And I have to put on my sort of business hat and say, okay, what is best for this company? And then at the same time, Patrick and I'll take an extra hour at the end of that meeting where we've gone through a chapter and verse and say, all right, now what do we want to do that's fun that nobody's done? And so we're looking at some ideas that no one's done. And my goal always is to expand the scope of human knowledge and, you know, science and exploration. And so it's a, you know, we look at, you know, what new techniques, what new, you know, modes of construction, how can we go deeper, cheaper, you know, because deep costs a lot of money. And there aren't too many players in that ultra deep realm, but you see that changing. It's interesting. Some of the big yacht clients are looking more at kind of expedition ships. I almost don't even want to call them yachts anymore.
That's right.
Because yeah. they're really purpose built ships to go and explore and see the world. And there are a lot of people, you know, who have those sorts of means that are curious individuals. That's probably what got them where they are in the first place. And they're fearless in the sense that they want to go see for themselves. And so I think that there's going to be a requirement on a lot of these proposed yacht projects for subs that not only can take in the wonder at shallow depth, but actually go and see things that the average person is not able to see, or even the average sub explorer is not able to see. And that's a very fun prospect. So we're looking at, you know, how do we do better lighting? How do we do better cameras so we can record what's seen, better battery systems, you know, longer life, all of those things, all of those engineering problems. See, I like engineering problems. I love them. You know, that's why, you know, I've been working on my own robotics and my own subs for years. So, you know, Patrick's got an incredible, you know, engineering base and engineering design base in the company, but the two of us together are kind of a powerhouse.
Yeah. And I mean, people, because I work in the space, so it seems like subs have been around for a long time, but they actually haven't. It's still a really, really new industry. The idea of a personal submersible, obviously in the professional and the research space, have been around for a while, but the concept of being able to buy a sub you can stick in your yacht or research vessel and go down to 300 feet it's still kind of a in
or 3,000 feet.
Exactly.
I think 300 feet's relatively easy. Yeah. 3,000 feet's a little trickier, obviously, and to do so safely. And these products are very reliable, very very well proven, and they're all, you know, fully registered and certified. And you know, the registration company goes through chapter and verse, goes through the engineering. It's certainly safer than, you know, owning your own airplane or your own helicopter, I would say, probably by an order of magnitude.
Mm. And so you mentioned the your work you're doing with OceanX and Ray Dalio. I mean, you and Ray presumably have known each other for quite some time, because and you share this deep love of ocean exploration. So where did you guys first meet and discover this shared passion?
It's been years now. We met through his son Mark doing some stuff with the Alusha 2. I mean, yeah. The Alusha, the original, because the OceanX was originally called Alusha 2. And Mark was doing some films, and I got to know him, and we were kind of assisting him in kind of thinking through how you do a big expedition-based series. And of course, Ray was kind of standing in the wings behind all that and wanting to do that himself. But I didn't really, it wasn't probably until 6 or 7 years ago that he and I really got the cut of each other's jib, so to speak, that we were both really passionate about the same things. And he was driven by genuine curiosity. You know, I think a lot of people get into subs and expedition ships because they kind of want to, you know, have it all, and that's fine too. But I think in Ray's case, and I know that of others like, you know, Paul Allen and Eric Schmidt, people that I've met that are all passionate about the ocean, it's a genuine desire to understand. It's a deep curiosity and wanting to put resources into the ocean to find answers. And of course, that's really talking my language.
Well, Ocean Explorer, Ray's expedition vessel, is probably the most advanced, the most exciting boat of its kind sailing the waters at the moment. So it's I mean, yeah, hugely exciting. Yeah. What a platform to use.
Well, Ray was very kind to include me in the early stages of that refit. And I said, look, I've done a number of ship-based expedition projects, including on, you know, the big Russian research vessel, the Keldysh, which I think it was 430 feet, 440 feet, something like that. And we took over, you know, considerable square footage inside that ship and converted it into, you know, a kind of remote TV station, a kind of a playback and media space where we could review our dive footage. We could gather the scientists. We had a kind of a high-tech lab space, and we kind of perked it all up with lighting and projection and big screens and things like that. And I said, we should do the same thing. If we're gonna do a media focused, you know, science platform with this ship, we should do the same thing. So he allowed me to bring in, you know, Hollywood production designers and just really kind of fit out the interior to be very camera friendly, and to look like a real audio visual, you know, space that where scientists could interact with their data. We even put in a HoloLens lab where they could visually interact with acoustic data and with photographic data and LIDAR data that had been captured, you know, on their dive series and so on. And they were able to do things like really start to model up, you know, how sperm whales and humpbacks were feeding and sperm whales were diving and things like that. So this was real science. It was also tremendously visual and tremendously exciting. Mm-hmm.
And what about you personally? How much time did you spend on Ocean Explorer during these missions?
My role was really in the setup. I was an executive producer. It was the setup and vetting the scripts and casting. Now, it's not really casting in the sense of actors, but we were looking for young scientists who were good communicators, who had legitimate science to do, that could be folded in to this kind of, you know, visual exploration and adventure that we wanted to bring to the audience. And so we had to very, very carefully select our team, our action team that would actually be out there in the water, diving in boats, in subs, and would sound knowledgeable. So it was really standing the whole thing up. Once the expedition got underway, you know, I looked at dailies and I'd talk with the showrunner and the producers and the on-site producers and so on. But I wasn't actually on the ship on this one. They were living my adventure life and my exploration life vicariously for me while I was making Avatar: The Way of Water.
And I mean, Ocean Explorer is kind of the apotheosis of kind of the research vessel concept. But there's lots of halfway houses. Lots of very wealthy people are building super yachts with significant research capabilities, carrying submarines and things like that. What's kind of your view on that? Is it simply that the more people out there researching, the better?
I think the more people feel connected to the ocean, especially people in positions of power, whether it's in business or whatever, the more we will take care of the oceans. That's my hope. And by the way, the more that is observed. So one of the things I've discussed with Triton is possibly, you know, having a centralized database of the imagery that's gathered from all the subs in such a way that we can use AI to identify species that are seen on a given dive and feed that back as a service to the client, so they can say, hey, I saw a squid, or I saw a coral, or I saw this, I saw that, what was it? And they can actually get, you know, we haven't stood this up yet, but they can actually get a kind of a list of everything that they're observing, so they become more knowledgeable. The more people become knowledgeable about the ocean, the more they fall in love with it, the more they're inclined to protect it. And we're going to need those voices, especially voices of people with influence, you know, to take the steps that we need to do to conserve that which we find so fascinating.
And why do you find it so fascinating? Where is that from? Is it innate? It's always been in you, or is it a moment in your life that kind of turned?
I think it's always been there. You know, I mean, I think so many people who are in love with the ocean grew up with the ocean. In my case, the ocean was a distant thing. It was a fantasy land, like another planet. I grew up in rural Canada, landlocked, I think 400 miles or so from the nearest ocean. But I was fascinated by the imagery that I saw in National Geographic magazine of the, you know, the exploration dives and some of the experiments like conch shell and man in the sea, tektite, programs like that, where people were living in habitats underwater, and the Jacques Cousteau films. So, you know, the 60s, when I was a kid, was a time of such amazing promise. You know, we were going to the moon, we were diving into the ocean, that everything seemed like science fiction stories were happening all around me for real. And I just wanted to be a part of that. So I learned to scuba dive, and then I formed my own direct relationship with the ocean, which was one of, you know, awe and wonder and curiosity. And every time I saw something that amazed me, I wanted to see more, and I wanted to see more beyond that. And of course, that leads you deeper. And then that leads to subs and remotely operated vehicles and methods for filming and recording that. And in 3D, in my case, in 2001, we did our first 3D deep ocean expedition, going back to the Titanic wreck site. And then we carried that on through, you know, the hydrothermal vent sites in the Atlantic and the Pacific and various other shipwrecks and so on. So there's so much down there to be seen and explored and understood. I mean, the thing I love about the deep ocean is every time you dive, every single time, you're going to see something you've never seen. And every once in a while, you're going to see something nobody's ever seen. And I've had a number of occasions where I've brought footage back onto the ship, and there are marine biologists there, and I say, what is that? And they say, I don't exactly know, but I think it might be related to this. And then you think, wow, I might have just seen a whole new species that's never been classified before. And that's pretty exciting. Or maybe something that was only brought up to the surface in a plankton troll net and was kind of partially disintegrated, and you haven't seen it yet in its natural habitat. And that's really the thrill for me, is just to go there and bear witness and to see what's down there and feel connected. It's an almost spiritual quest for me in many ways. And to me, that's my sacred time. That's my church down there.
I mean, and you've been down there, literally all the way down there. You've been deeper than anybody. So what, can you tell us a bit about that experience?
Well, I think it's believed now that there are a number of people that have all been as deep as each other, right? Because the deepest spot on the planet is basically as flat as a billiard table when you get down there. Yes, it's at the bottom of the Challenger Deep, which is a part of the Mariana Trench system, but it's what they call ponded sediment, which means that every time there's one of these big disruptive seismic events, it all kind of goes into solution and then settles out like milk solids, you know, so it's pretty flat. So Don Walsh and Jacques Picard, for example, went down in 1960 in the Trieste. I went down in the Deep Sea Challenger And we discovered more or less the same thing on our respective dives, and then others have been down there since then. And it's really quite amazing. It's the most distant place on this planet that you can get from humanity and our surface world as we understand it up here, you know, pretty close to 35,800 feet, somewhere in there. We're never quite sure how deep it is, because as the water column changes above you with currents and salinities and so on, your measurements based on pressure kind of fluctuate a bit. So there's a bit of an error band down there, but it's somewhere around 35,800 feet.
And I'm just trying to get, is it an emotional experience being down there?
Absolutely. It's a very emotional experience. First of all, the technical exercise of designing a vehicle, building that vehicle, testing it, test diving it in successively deeper and deeper and deeper trenches until you finally get to the kind of underwater Everest, that inverted Everest, and you go down. And then, and in my particular case, it was strange to be falling past the deepest point I'd been before was 5 miles. And then that long last fall of that extra 2 miles down, where it's just very quiet and you're more alone than you can imagine being. And then to see that seafloor starting to become visible in your lights and realize that we've done it. The entire technical team standing behind me had done it. They'd done their jobs right. I was there, I'd made it, you know. And then once I was there, just curiosity, like, what's here? So starting to look around, drive around, try to understand the geology, look for small animals. In the course of our expedition, we discovered on the order of 100 new species. Some of them were very small, some of them were bacteria, some of them were little holothurians and things like that. You don't get the big animals when you go very, very deep, because there isn't enough food for them to live on. It's an energy poor environment, but, you know, biologically speaking, it just, they live on the filtered sort of protein that drifts down from above, you know, kind of snow, as they call it. So the big stuff is down in the kind of 200 to 500 meter depth range. And so there's a big opportunity for people that are buying these subs that can go to that depth range. So just take a look at that layer of it's the biggest biomass on Earth. You don't even have to be diving down a wall or coral or anything like that. You can just drop off in the middle of the ocean if it's a fertile, let's say an upwelling area near a seamount or something like that, and the water will just be alive with so much biomass. And you can do what's called the flashback, where you take a strobe and you fire it out into that inky black night, and everything just lights up in response. The bioluminescent animals will answer you back. Wow. And you'll just see galaxies of movement and life out there in the water if you get into that, you know, that twilight zone, that deep scattering layer, you know, where all the animals live. Because what they do is they come up to feed in shallower water at night, and they go back down into the darkness during the daytime. But you can go down there with your sub and see all that bioluminescence.
Remarkable to think also that there is life, and so much life, right at the bottom of Challenger Deep and places like that, because you so associate life with light, and down there there's of course none.
Right.
But
right,
that doesn't stop life.
Well, in a place like that where there's no hydrothermal activity at the bottom, it's all based on that primary production, all that you know, growing up in the photic zone, right? The plankton grows, and then the zooplankton eat that, and then everybody eats that. So there's a lot of just sort of protein snow coming down and coating the bottom. So it's ultimately solar powered. It's just 7 miles down.
Yeah.
But the really interesting life is at the hydrothermal vents, because that's not solar powered. That's powered by chemosynthesis. That's dissolved nutrients shooting up in these hot water jets out of the, you know, out of the rock layers down there. You know, you've got these kind of these magma structures down there, and then it's superheated water comes shooting up, and it brings up all these nutrients. And the profusion of life at these hydrothermal vents is just mind-boggling when you see it. You can see acres and acres and acres just teeming with whether it's mussels or shrimp or tube worms. It's really like going to another planet.
And is that part of it? There's so much more to discover, isn't there? And
yes.
So it's so exciting. It's such a frontier.
Well, every single hydrothermal vent community that I went to around the world was different. And so how many hydrothermal communities are there, right? All you do is look at a hydrographic map of the world, and you see all of the spreading centers that run around the world like the seams of a baseball. And you think, who's really gone down and looked at most of those places? I'd be estimating off the top of my head, but I would say 70, 80% of it, nobody's even looked. And yet every single place we look, we find new species and different animals and varied ecosystems. There are some places they're dominated by tube worms, some places they're dominated by other animals. And there are all these kind of niche ecosystems. So there's so much more to be discovered.
And is it deliberate that this your fascination with the ocean has bled into your creative career with the movies, with Titanic and the Avatar movies, etc.?
I don't know if it's as deliberate as it is just natural. You know, it's a natural feedback loop for me. I love the oceans. I love thinking about the oceans. Sometimes an idea will manifest itself, and I'll take that and I'll run with it for a screenplay. And it's also a closed loop feeding back the other direction, where I go out and I satisfy myself artistically and I make some money with the movies, and then I come back and now I want to go satisfy my curiosity and actually invest my time and energy and capital into building vehicles, building lights, building subs, that sort of thing, and then go out and really find out what's going on. So there's an incorrect connection of the dots that goes like this. Oh, Cameron's a movie maker, so he's just going to look in the ocean to give himself ideas for his next science fiction movie. It's like, are you kidding me? I got lots of ideas. I don't need to go into the ocean to get ideas. I go into the ocean to find out what's there and to satisfy my curiosity. And it's driven by science, in the sense that I won't go out and mount an expedition if I don't bring scientists with me and enable their access that they might not be able to get through the normal sort of grant writing system. You know, I love to take scientists out with me and have them discover new things and then write it up and publish and so on. So it's not the movies. It's not doing the expeditions to facilitate better movie making. It's doing the movie making to facilitate the science and the exploration.
I love that. Making the biggest movies of all time to facilitate your hobby of, well, not hobby,
as a means to an end.
Yeah.
See, for most people in Hollywood, it would be the end in and of itself. I think that's a very unhealthy way to be, because then it's a bit capricious, and now you're at the whim of critics and award ceremonies and fickle audiences and things like that. What I like about the engineering and actually building machines to go function in the ocean, the deep ocean, which I think is the most hostile environment for human machinery that one could imagine, far worse than building stuff to go into space, which is relatively benign in a lot of ways. You know, the reason I like it is because it's not up to some critic whether my robotic vehicle will work, you know, 16,000 feet down. It's just we did the engineering right. You know, I always like to say the second law of thermodynamics is not an opinion. It's a law. And there are a lot of physical laws that you have to obey to get your stuff to be successful, you know, in the ocean.
And one of your one of those movies referenced was obviously Titanic, and you've seen the Titanic, you've dived the Titanic. So,
well, just to put that in perspective, I've spent more time on Titanic than the captain did.
Oh, isn't that incredible? What a great start!
And certainly more than any of the passengers did.
Yeah. And so, seeing it for the first time, do you remember that moment looming out of the deep? This great wreck.
The first time I saw Titanic, we were coming in tangentially to the bow, and the first thing I saw was some mounded up bottom clay. It actually looked like it had been plowed up, and I'm talking quite tall now, maybe 3 meters, 3 or 4 meters. And I actually understood what it was before the Russian pilot did. I said, "We're at the bow. This is where it hit the bottom." I said, just go forward. And I literally was telling the guy what to do, because I had studied the bathymetry. I'd studied the sonar from Woods Hole Oceanographic. I'd studied models and reconstructions. And I said, all right, go forward very slowly and just rise up. Be careful. And there it was, right in front of us, this wall of steel, this big black wall. And in fact, we were at the bow on the starboard side. And I actually knew my way around the wreck, because I had pre-visualized the dives We built a big model of the wreck based on all the photography that Woods Hole had done when Ballard originally found it. They scanned the whole thing from end to end with the Argo towed vehicle, right? And we were able to reconstruct a physical model from that. Today, I'd do a computer model so I could turn it, you know, quickly and modify it very, very easily. But at the time, we just built a big 15-foot long physical model, and I memorized that model. And so when we actually saw it for the first time, actually, first we saw it on sonar. And then as we approached, we, you know, the first thing to manifest was that really overturned seafloor that had just been shoved by the ship when it hit the bottom, like an axe digging in, you know, the bow of the ship went in 40 feet into the sediment and pushed to the side. It's quite dramatic when you see it. And then you come up over the ship, and we had our very bright lights mounted on the Russian submersibles. We could light up pretty much the whole forecastle of the ship, probably for about 120 feet, something like that. And it's a magnificent wreck. I mean, it's really quite stunning if anybody gets a chance. And you know, we're looking at Triton because we're forward thinking. You know, we want to build deep subs that can satisfy that yearning and that curiosity for, you know, some of the higher end clients that are really interested in that. Others, I think, just want to go down and just want to kind of mind meld with the ocean and just see the beauty and go down a little deeper than you could with scuba or in the comfort of a sub. And maybe with somebody there that can tell you, you know, explain what you're seeing until you become, you know, kind of more of an expert observer yourself. And that's all fine. We enable that. Subs of all different sizes. You can share that experience with your friends. And I think obviously that's the biggest part of the market. But what excites me also is the people who have that natural explorer gene and want to go deeper and want to have access and want to be able to drive their ship someplace where people maybe haven't taken a look at all. And that's, you know, that's the most amazing thing to me. When I know I'm dropping down onto a site that no one's looked at, that's exciting.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So is it conceivable in the not too distant future, there'll be a recreational sub a yacht owner could buy that could dive the Titanic?
It's not only conceivable, we're planning it.
Wow.
Absolutely. So Titanic, so you have different classifications. You sort of have the 100 meter sub, which is quite spacious and you know, you can, you know, take a larger number of people. The farther you go down, the more it sort of necks down. Ultimately, I think the irreducible number wants to be three. You know, Patrick has made a very strong argument that he's seen subs come and go over the years, and he's seen various business models, and the irreducible number wants to be three, because you've got a pilot, and then you've got to have the owner, and then whoever the owner wants to share that experience with, mm-hmm. whether it's a friend, a spouse, or maybe with a science advisor, observer right on board that can tell them what it is they're seeing. So you definitely want that three-person capability. And so we're looking at taking that idea and going deeper and deeper with it, but trying to do it within a practical cost range, not the kind of big expensive programs that were institutional programs back in the, I'd say the 60s through the 90s were the time of the big institutional government funded, academic funded, you know, deep exploration vehicles. And they were sort of $50 to $100 million programs. But we've learned enough that we can be lean and mean by comparison to that and duplicate that capability in a smaller package, ultimately more reliable, and offer that in a way that's never been offered before.
Well, that would just be incredible.
Isn't that exciting?
Oh, so exciting. And I wonder, I mean, there've been other shipwrecks, there's deeper shipwrecks, there's shipwrecks that have cost more lives. What is it about the Titanic?
The allure? Yeah. Well, Titanic is, I mean, it's a tragedy, so this might sound a little bit wrong, but it's almost like a perfect novel of a story. Yes, there have been many, many greater tragedies subsequent to Titanic, ships where 5,000 people have died in the sinking and so on, you know, dwarfing the scale of Titanic. But I don't think it's about the numbers. That's just statistics. I think it's about the nature of the story, mm-hmm. and the kind of the fact that it sank slowly. There was a kind of time for people to face their fate and to make the difficult decisions. There was a chivalric code in the time. The ship wasn't violent in the way it sank, other than the last couple minutes. It stayed relatively on an even keel, and nobody quite knows why, although our operant theory is that those engineers were running down around down below decks, pumping ballast back and forth and trying to keep the ship, desperately trying to keep the ship trimmed so that they could get the lifeboats lowered down those tall flanks of that ship from sometimes 70, 80 feet up in the air, get those lifeboats in the water. I think it was a heroic effort because ships tend to loll as they take on water. It's just a natural thing due to free surface effect. And as they, in the initial stage of the flooding, they'll take a set. And once they've taken that set, it tends to just positively reinforce until the ship is sitting at a lull. And then they couldn't have gotten any of the damn lifeboats off the one whole side of the ship. So it's kind of an amazing in the way it physically sank. And then the dramas that played out on deck with fathers saying goodbye to their children, husbands saying goodbye to their wives, stepping back from boats that they felt were too crowded to be able to be lowered. It turned out they could have shoved a lot more people into the boats and saved a lot more lives, but that's not really the point. The point is what was going through the minds of everyone in those last moments. You know, who were the heroes who saw their duty in self-sacrifice? There were very few instances of cowardice in the whole thing, and I think even those are trumped up and were a bit of a classist kind of revision of what was happening there. Oh, those steerage people were trying to knock the gates down and clamber into the boats and all that, but that's not really what happened. It was all quite orderly, and there's something kind of majestic about it. And then, of course, the chaos of the last few minutes as the ship just reared up with its stern sticking straight up against the stars, and what a wild ride that must have been. And of course, we dramatized that in the movie, I think quite accurately.
Oh, it's an amazing moment in the movie. But I read an incredible story about the other day about one of the last guys clinging on as the stern of the ship was going through. He survived.
Yeah, he was the chief baker. His name was Jaugen, and he said he rode it down like an elevator and stepped off into the water and didn't get his hair wet. And he literally describes the ship going straight down underneath him and the water coming up. And so his testimony is what I based Jack and Rose's experience upon. And if you actually watch the movie closely, there's a moment where Rose looks over and there's a guy in a baker's outfit next to her on the railing. Well, that's Chief Baker Jaugen.
Well, I have to watch it again now.
Go ahead. It's being re-released.
Yeah, well, I can't wait, actually. It introduces the kids. That would be fantastic. And I appreciate you're incredibly busy. So just a couple more questions, if you don't mind. Given you have spent so much time diving the wreck, is there any of your research has led to, has advanced our understanding of how it happened?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, so I've been diving that wreck and studying it forensically and working with marine forensics people, marine archaeologists for 27 years now. And I think between myself and a small group of experts that form a little kind of, you know, rivet counting network of expertise, we've basically proposed the generally accepted operating model for what happened to the ship in its final minutes, the breakup at the surface, how it disintegrated as it sank, how the two sections separated, impacted the bottom. And what you have to do is you've got to study the wreck very carefully and kind of exfoliate the layers. Okay, you've got to see, well, what happened in the 100 years, you know, ish since the ship sank? There's some sort of decomposition due to biological activity, mostly, which is what's interesting about it. Those rusticles, those pendulous structures are actually biology at work, you know, actually reducing the wreck, bacteria colonies. So you strip that away, and then you say, all right, what happened when it hit the bottom? You strip that 100 years away. Now, what did it look like when it hit the bottom fresh? What is damage that's associated with that bottom impact? Now you have to strip that away. Say, now what is damage that's associated with it actually fracturing at the surface? What is damage associated with it screaming down through the water column at high speed before it stabilized and fell through and settled more slowly? And we can see all that. We can see the flow dynamics across the whole bow section of the ship and how it flayed open the officers' quarters very symmetrically and laid the walls out flat on the deck and slammed the mask back and blew the davits off and they all came off in one big jumble of ropes and davits and wound up deposited right underneath the where the ship broke up at the surface. And so we've spent probably way too many hours to be truly healthy about it psychologically on figuring out exactly what happened. Like one would kind of reverse engineer an air crash to figure out what the proximal causes were. The one thing we've never seen is the actual damage from the iceberg, because it's been overwritten so much. It's like looking for a scrape on a Toyota that's subsequently gone off a cliff and rolled 300 feet down the cliff and then, you know, hit the ocean, you know. So we've never quite seen that yet. And it's all buried. It's all buried under the bottom sediment. You know, my fantasy was always to take a small robotic vehicle inside, which I've done. I've flown all through the inside of that wreck with our little robotic vehicles. We go down with the sub, we fly the vehicle off the sub, and then we take it down through stairways and through all the rooms and corridors and doorways and everything. It's really quite amazing. But I always wanted to get into that forward hold and see if I could see it from the inside, broken in, the way it might have looked to somebody who was in there at the exact moment of the impact. But I actually believe that it's all sort of crushed down and deformed from the bottom impact. The impact with the bottom was a far more energetic impact than the one with the iceberg, which was relatively tame. Most people didn't even feel it on board the ship, or they felt a bit of a judder, kind of almost, you know, like a very mild earthquake.
So we might never know exactly
what happened. Well, we know. I mean, we know what happened. We can sort of fill in that bit of it because they did a survey right afterwards where they could see where the flooding was, and there were witnesses who saw a bit of the last part of the iceberg damage in boiler room 6. That was actually directly witnessed. So we sort of know what happened. And that's not a point of big interest. There are some mysteries still to be solved about what was happening with down in the boiler rooms with moving coal back and forth, because there was a fire on the ship a lot of people don't know about. And they were having to get that one coal fire in that one bunker. They were having to get that coal into the furnaces as quickly as possible and or shift some of it over into another bunker. And we actually have a hypothesis that the ship was slightly out of trim when it hit the iceberg, and that may have actually helped it stay on an even keel, because it started canted the other way. It had a bit of a port list due to this, you know, kind of madcap bunkering that was going on below deck. But I mean, look, if you're at all interested in nautical themes, and presumably a lot of the you know, big yacht community are pretty fascinated by nautical themes, the Titanic is an almost, you know, endless well of amazement to me. And, you know, our forensic work is ongoing, and we hope to publish a paper here in about a year that's pretty definitive about everything that we've discovered over the last 27 years.
And what's left for you to discover, I wonder?
There's a whole ocean out there. I'm less interested in wrecks, I think, going forward than I am in the biology and the geology of the deep ocean, and certainly that twilight zone, that kind of zone right below the photic zone where all the animals go to hide out during the day. That's where the rubber's really meeting the road. That's where the profusion of life really is, and that's where all the unknown species are going to be discovered in the next few years.
Any more wrecks like Titanic on your hit list, or is it so it's more about the biology, like you said?
Well, for me it's more about the biology. I mean, if I was going to do a wreck story, the Battle of Midway is fascinating. You've got the Yorktown which sunk, and the and then the four fast carriers, the four Japanese fast carriers that were sunk in by the American aerial bombardment. And those, one of them has been located, but three of them haven't. And it would be interesting to because it was such a pivotal battle in the Pacific War. And I love history, and those wrecks would certainly be worth it. And they're all deep. They're all in the kind of 9 to 14,000 foot depth range. We're not quite there yet, but you know, Patrick and I have definitely been talking about a 4,000 meter sub and a 6,000 meter sub to offer. As the 4,000 meter sub is more on the horizon, the 6,000 meter sub we're just We're just going down that path and looking at what that would look like. It's just getting the loose metrics on it. But it's all technically possible. There's so much new technology around material science and composites and exotic materials and glasses, exotic glasses and so on, that I love applying the new tech to the problem of getting down there into the depths, either personally or with camera systems.
Actually, I'll just ask you one last question, if I may. On, obviously, we're used to seeing the Triton subs with the big acrylic spheres. When you're talking about subs going to the depths you are, what will the viewing experience be like with advanced glass and acrylics?
Very similar.
It's very similar.
The viewing experience, I think what we found is that even for scientific observation, but certainly for recreational observation, people want that unrestricted view. And it's actually better. It's better spatial awareness for the pilot. It's better for actual scientific observation. It's certainly better if you're just going for the awe and wonder. And small portholes have been the paradigm since the beginning of research submersibles, and we're moving away from that now.
Well, I can't wait to see it. And I will be petitioning Patrick and the whole Triton crew to grab a seat on one of those Titanic dives in the future. I couldn't imagine a bigger bucket list item than that. Jim, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's Big Boat interview. Great insight there into the mind of one of the world's greatest filmmakers. This episode was mixed and produced by Adam Geist and Naomi Wilson and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.